Hello and welcome to the Wrestling 20 Years Ago podcast. My name is Bob Bamber and we're jumping back in the time machine to December of 1993. I've been joined by my co-host Craig Wilson. Craig, good evening.
Hello there.
A little bit of sad news in that Corin Judkins, who regular listeners will have heard over the past few months, has decided to pull out of the project. Fully understandable. He's got more important things to do. Much more important things to do. So that's fully understandable. It's going to be me and Craig fine for here on out. I don't rule out bringing Colin Brack in for some future shows, but he's not going to be the regular like he used to be. That means that I'm taking up the slack. Thanks, Colin, for all of his work. So I'm going to kick us off with the news this week with, first of all, that Hulk Hogan has been named in the steroid trial. It has been said, it was reported by the New York Daily News on November 24th that he helped the United States government indict Vince McMahon by cooperating with the grand jury. Previously, stories are reported that a quote-unquote unidentified WWF wrestler was known to the grand jury but not publicly named. That wrestler was alleged to have been supplied with steroids from Titan Sports and Vince McMahon at a time between March 1988 and October 1989.
Over in WCW, Ric Flair's first Starrcade since 1990 was one to remember as he won the WCW World Heavyweight Championship from Vader. The win came in front of a hometown North Carolina crowd in the main event of the show and rounded off a largely subpar event.
Bobby Heenan has left the WWF. He was escorted off the December 6th edition of Monday Night Raw by Gorilla Monsoon, and that will be his last appearance on WWF television. It is all but confirmed that Heenan will be joining with WCW, although details beyond that at this stage are unclear. It should be noted that Jesse Ventura's contract is up soon. On TV at least, there has been no full-time replacement for Heenan on commentary, with both Jim Cornette and Shawn Michaels doing guest spots.
On the November 1993 show, we discussed the incident that took place between Arn Anderson and Sid Vicious on WCW's European tour. Now we can report that Sid has left the company. No word yet on where he's going, but after being fired from the WWF for failing a drug test, it'd be surprising if he was to return there.
More departure news is Mr. Perfect Kurt Hennig has left the WWF. That's really it. We don't know any more than that. He's left. There are rumours going around that he's been negotiating with WCW, but at this stage, nothing more to report.
The theme of departures continues. The British Bulldog Davey Boy Smith has left to WCW. He was fired by the company after an altercation with a man in a bar and the ensuing legal problems from that. It is believed that the man had been making advances towards Smith's wife. Prior to this, though, he had been scheduled to enter a programme with Rick Rude over the WCW International World Heavyweight Championship.
The Royal Rumble coming up next month features its lineup as WWF champion Yokozuna facing The Undertaker in a casket match for the WWF title, Razor Ramon versus IRS for the Intercontinental title, and the Quebecers will be facing the team of Bret and Owen Hart for the WWF tag team titles, along, of course, with the Royal Rumble match. Dave Meltzer, the Wrestling Observer, says that current plans point towards Lex Luger facing Yokozuna for the title at WrestleMania, with Bret Hart being promised to win the belt from Luger at SummerSlam.
The entire Smoky Mountain Wrestling roster required a police escort to get away from a show in Wise, Virginia. The kerfuffle kicked off after Jim Cornette reportedly used the N-word when addressing a local black guy working as security. The incident saw the crowd battle Cornette, his charges, the Heavenly Bodies, as well as the Bruise Brothers, the team that the Bodies were facing in the ring. No word yet on when Smoky Mountain Wrestling will return to Wise, Virginia, but as that's a good area for them, it wouldn't be good for business if they didn't go back.
Right, that'll wrap up the news. We're going to start with our review of WCW Starrcade. The results from this show were as follows. Paul Orndorff and Paul Roma defeated Too Cold Scorpio and Marcus Bagwell. The Shockmaster defeated one of the Kongs. We'll come to that in a minute. Lord Steven Regal fought Ricky Steamboat to a time limit draw for the WCW Television Championship. Cactus Jack and Max Payne defeated Tex Slazenger and Shanghai Pierce. Steve Austin defeated Dustin Rhodes in a 2-out-of-3 falls match for the WCW United States Heavyweight Championship. Rick Rude defeated The Boss in a match for the WCW International World Heavyweight Championship. Sting and Road Warrior Hawk defeated the Nasty Boys by disqualification for the WCW Tag Team Championship. In the main event, Ric Flair defeated Vader to win the WCW World Heavyweight Championship. Craig, we will go through the show in chronological order, but I think we are going to end up talking about Flair and Vader disproportionately large amount of time, although not in terms of how it played out. But your thoughts overall on the full card and the main event?
It's probably fair that we focus most of our attentions on the main event. The rest of it was pretty sorry, unfortunately. I thought WCW had started to move in the right direction in terms of their shows. Should there have been hiccups along the way, and we've criticised the false finishes and poor endings in some of the matches, but I just thought the rest of the card left a lot to be desired here. You take the opening, I know we're going to go through it, the opening tag match was pretty standard affair, but everything else was, I thought, a little bit poorer than that. The Austin Reynolds match showed that the two of them could potentially have some good chemistry in the future, but they didn't seem overly familiar with themselves at this stage. But I think my main criticism of the show has to be the fact that the match between the Nasties and Hawk and Sting was afforded 30 minutes. It certainly didn't warrant that length of time on the show.
Yeah, I mean, we'll come to it as we get there. A couple of notes. Firstly, while I remember, Davey Boy Smith was due to face Rick Rude. He obviously left the company, as we spoke about in the news, which explains why the boss was in this match. Also reported following the event, apparently Sags, who was in the tag match against Sting and Red Warrior Hawk, was injured. And apparently they might have been making that finish up on the fly, although not that the Nasty Boys and Missy Hyatt need an excuse to have a DQ finish. So that might affect that as well. But we'll start with the opener while we plough through the show. As you say, it was just not a lot to write home about. It was an okay opener. Paul Orndorff and Paul Roemer against Too Cold Scorpio and Marcus Alexander Bagwell. I'm still high on Too Cold Scorpio, as we mentioned in the past. And this was an okay match. A nice opener. I don't think it was any more or any less than that.
No, I think that's right. I mean, it might sound slightly harsh, but it really was tag team match by numbers. There was nothing sort of particularly special there. But on the other hand, there wasn't anything terribly bad either. So it's difficult to be too critical of the match. But if you'd seen this event on a TV show, on a WCW Saturday Night or Worldwide, you'd have thought it'd have been a perfectly acceptable match. But that above and beyond that, it's difficult to really say too much more about it.
The Shockmaster officially, at least, defeated Awesome Kong, although the person in the ring was wearing King Kong trunks, so what that's worth. My major note on this is that, one, I sort of understand why Shockmaster is being afforded 90-second squash matches on WCW pay-per-views. They had nothing. And secondly, the referee, Shockmaster comes out, and he's obviously the babyface, and the two heels come out and start beating him up, and the referee does nothing about it. And then, like, one of them leaves the ring and the match starts. It's like, well, what kind of precedent is that? If we're going to try and treat it as a real sport, why would you allow that?
No, absolutely. There are probably more questions than answers that come from this match. But yeah, that whole stuff just seemed really strange. But the idea that anything's going to be saved from the Shockmaster project by him getting a squash victory over two guys that have no connection whatsoever with the WCW audience. It's difficult really to justify its inclusion. And I hate squash matches on a pay-per-view as well, so I'm not going to defend this one.
Lord Steven Regal versus Ricky Steamboat. That went to a time limit draw. It's kind of what you'd expect from these two. It was slow, it was methodical, it wasn't necessarily bad or great in either extent of the extreme. It was an okay match. The thing I was probably... The one note I really put down for this match was that, yeah, we're speaking about Bobby Heenan possibly coming. I actually thought this was kind of showed how good Jesse Ventura can be, in the sense that they were setting up for a time limit draw. So Ventura, you know, repeatedly said this is smart by Regal, using the mechanics of the match in terms of if it goes 15 minutes, it'll end in a draw. And one thing I liked was he got it in his head that Regal didn't have to win the match. He only had to avoid losing. And I thought that was an interesting dynamic. And I thought that was kind of showed one of Ventura's strengths as an announcer.
Yeah, no, I think so. I think one of my favourite things through 1993 WCW, and something I'm going to come back to later on in this podcast, but I've really enjoyed Ventura's commentating, and I enjoyed it in the WWF in the mid to late 80s, and I'm enjoying it in WCW, he tells a very good story. And sometimes when the stuff going on in the ring isn't of a great standard, and this year certainly wasn't of a great standard, but wasn't a bad standard, he was able to tell a pretty good story. I think the most telling thing for me from this match is the fact that very early on into it, he started getting rest holds from Ricky Steamboat, of all people. I mean, if that doesn't indicate you're going to get the draw result here, then nothing will.
Cactus Jack and Max Payne defeated Tex Slazenger and Shanghai Pierce. I just kind of felt a bit sorry for Cactus Jack that he was even in this match.
This is really another nothing match. I don't totally dislike Slazenger and Pierce, though. I think that they're not bad. They're just sort of a tag team there. Again, if you saw them competing on Worldwide or Saturday Night, you wouldn't terribly be interested. And I just don't see any reason to include them on this pay-per-view. The more I'm talking about this event, it's dragging down the original rating that I'd given it.
Well, we'll see. Although, I think everything from here on out drags it down when we get to the main event. On the subject of that, you always kind of wonder, why would you employ techs such as Shanghai Pierce and the Awesome Kongs? It's like, just have one fat tag team rather than two.
Yeah, and I would go for Slazenger and Pierce, because they look marginally better.
Well,
it's close, though.
Yeah, it is. Steve Austin defeated Dustin Rhodes in a 2 out of 3 falls match to win the WCW United States Heavyweight Championship. As you motioned to at the top of the part, this was a good match, which probably promised more than maybe, or maybe promised more for the future than maybe it delivered in this incarnation. There was the odd factor, though, that this was 2 falls to 0, which is rare in a 2 out of 3 falls match these days. But there was the odd fact that Austin won one of the falls by DQ and then won the title. I mean, it wasn't the main one, but it's kind of skewing with the rules a bit.
Yeah, there was a tag team match involving the Hart Foundation in the late 80s where it was a 2 out of 3 falls and the Harts won the Harts were the champions. I think they lost the first fall by DQ and it ended up being 2-1, but because one was a DQ then there was no title change. It didn't really make a lot of sense. On paper this was looking very much like the match of the night candidate, and the two Rhodes and Austin are clearly very talented young guys, and they're probably going to enter into a program now over the US title, and I think that's a very good thing, but this one flattered to deceive a little bit.
Rick Rude against The Boss for the WCW International World Heavyweight title. Again, it's, you know, these are kind of wider problems that we're talking about. Rick Rude having a string of average but no better pay-per-view matches. Okay, this one wasn't helped by the fact that this should have been Davey Boy Smith, who he was facing. And again, the WCW International title, which is kind of almost feels like it's struggling for a bit of identity, really. Kind of, where is it on the card?
Yeah, no, it was something, and now it's kind of nothing. Which is a shame for Rude, because he's clearly a very talented worker. But you hit upon it. It's the idea that, well, the whole Smith leaving, that hurt this match, because then you're just left thinking, why is The Boss getting a title shot here? I think my favourite thing of the match was in the replay afterwards when Ventura called him Boss Man.
Yep, no, can't compare that. Sting and Road Warrior Hawk defeated the Nasty Boys with Missy Hyatt by disqualification in a match for the WCW Tag Team Championships. This went 29 minutes, but I have to say, it wasn't great by any stretch of the imagination, and I think I probably liked it a bit more than you did. One, it was helped by the fact that the crowd was hot and they had Sting, who the WCW crowd are way behind. As Nasty Boys matches go, and if we, you know, maybe they had a different plan, match finish planned, this wasn't all bad. This was actually a decent match. It did go too long, but I got to the end of it not thinking, God, this match has been really boring, because there was enough to keep you in it, but more thinking, wow, this match has gone so long and yet you delivered a really bad finish.
Yeah, you're probably right. Maybe I'm being slightly too critical over it. I mean, you're never going to draw comparisons between a tag team match involving the Nasty Boys and a match between Ric Flair and Steamboat and NWA, but it was just, the crowd were hot, because the crowd are always going to be behind Sting and they're always going to be behind Hawk, but it is that thing. Maybe it was maybe it wasn't the planned finish the way it went, but in the end he did just get a 30-minute match that ended with a DQ. But you, of course, you've obviously hit on that reason, but I don't know. I love tag team wrestling as well, but I'd happily live without having to watch another Nasty Boys match.
That's true, and it is also worth saying that even if they did do the finish on the fly, it's not to say they didn't have another disqualification finish planned.
Quite.
That should be pointed out, and it is the Nasty Boys, so I'd happily bet on that. And then we get to the main event. I mean, we should preface all this before we get to Vader and Flair by saying that this match wasn't the plan. As you notioned to earlier on, when Sid Vicious has left the company this month, Sid Vicious was going to go over in this match. They were going to build through him on TV throughout December. He was going to beat Vader here, and then Sid Vicious was going to be the guy going into 1994. That was the plan. And Ric Flair, I presume, would have been in that match with Sting. That's where I think he would have been. And so, as much as Craig, we're going to quite rightly call not only the match, but the build as well, as deserving as being spectacular in places, WCW did luck into this.
Yes, absolutely. It's probably fair to say that the North Carolina crowd wouldn't have cared quite so much about Sid in this match. But obviously, Flair being there, that really did... It came close to saving this pay-per-view, this main event.
But yeah, I mean, I think before we get to the match, we should really talk about the build, because at least in the first kind of half hour, 40 minutes, they built to it quite nicely. I mean, they started with Mean Gene Okerlund at Ric Flair's house, interviewing Ric Flair's family, including his wife, which was odd given that Ric Flair has been accompanied to the ring by Fifi a lot recently. They just glossed over that. And then we had these montages of Mean Gene Okerlund, not montage, but these clips of Mean Gene Okerlund with Ric Flair in a limo going to the arena. All very good. I thought they played the atmosphere pretty nicely in terms of Mean Gene Okerlund setting the stage, because this was Ric Flair's career on the line. It could have been his final match in his hometown. But with these limo scenes, Craig, I got to the stage where I thought, if I was Flair, I think I'd tell Mean Gene Okerlund to bugger off. I mean, he was being so negative, talking about how, you know, this could be the end, you could lose it in front of all your fans. And if I was Flair, I don't want to hear that.
No, it couldn't have done a terrible amount for Flair's self-esteem going through the event, though.
No. but no, as I said, and there was that, and they showed clips of Vader arriving to the arena earlier in the day, and I like how they contrasted that Flair kind of almost, you know, Flair in theory at least left after the show had started. They said that Vader, and they even showed pictures of Vader arriving much earlier in the day, and they showed a quick montage of Vader kind of warming up with Harley Race before anyone kind of arrived in the arena. So I think they built this as a big fight feel, and maybe it needed, as good as the build was, I actually thought maybe they could have done with one or two more bits. But I mean, the other thing was, and maybe they should have shown this just before the main event rather than in the pre-show, I thought they did a tremendous job with a video package of Flair. I mean, all right, by this point, we're just thinking, right, yeah, Flair's going over. Not that anyone thought he was going to retire anyway. They showed this great montage of pictures of Flair early in his career, and some footage of him facing Harley Race, ironically, and other people like that, and some of his big career highlights up to that stage. In terms of the build, Craig, where does this compare with other wrestling builds on TV in recent months and years?
I really liked it. Like you say, it gave it the big match feel, and it did sort of make it feel like an actual sporting contest. I really liked that aspect of it. It added a lot to the importance. Obviously, it was a big deal because it's Flair in front of his hometown crowd. They probably could have done a little bit more with Vader, what with him being champion, but I mean, it was all about Flair trying to rescue his career. The stuff with his family, despite the issues with who accompanies Flair down to the ring, like you pointed out, was good. It really just crossed that boundary. It made it seem like, oh, his family are really worried. It's real. It gave it that sort of feel. So I really liked it, but like you say, there was no doubt that Flair was going over, something that Schiavone made abundantly clear in the very early stages of his commentary as well.
Well, there's that. I mean, to come to the match itself, I mean, you said there was no doubt, and you are right, but what it kind of allowed them to do, given that kind of everyone thought, was that it was a 22-minute match, and for about 18 minutes, Vader basically just battered Ric Flair.
Yeah, he did. He really pummeled him. I also really liked Race during this match. You heard a lot from Race on the sidelines. There was obviously the odd bits of interference, but I liked the fact that that play harked back to their Starrcade match as well. It just added another dimension to this one. Just the bad blood and everything. I really liked it a lot to do with this match. There's only two things, two negatives for me on this match, but the rest of it I really, really liked.
What were the two negatives?
Flair missing the top rope axe handle and Vader selling it, and I thought the finish was quite weak as well, but that aside, those are two minor criticisms of what, other than that, was a fairly flawless build-up and match.
Yeah, I mean, to come to the finish, I mean, Flair kind of went to cover Vader after Vader missed a Vader salt, and then Harley Race kind of climbed up onto the top rope and kind of fell over, attempting a diving headbutt. Flair rolled out the way, so Vader landed on top. Race landed on top of Vader. They got up. Vader knocked Flair over. Flair then managed to kind of like tip Vader onto his back and kind of just cradle him for what was almost a roll up and a three count, which I think surprised a lot of people. It was a finish that, as you say, it was the crowd went berserk, which was not to be surprised about. But it was a finish that, given how kind of sudden it was, and also given that Flair never really cinched in that pin, because the ref counted pretty much when Vader's shoulder first hit the mat, and Flair kind of tried to roll him up, and he never had him static. And I think that almost, well, not that it confused the people in the crowd. I mean, I think it also helped that the ref counted very loudly. And the crowd clearly didn't mind, but I thought that took a little bit the edge off it, but it did give Flair a decisive victory, a clean victory, but it didn't take anything away from Vader, because it's hard to imagine Flair being able to pin Vader any other way. And okay, he's got the figure four leg lock, but do you really want to have Vader tapping out? I'm not sure. So as much as I have a few qualms about how it was done, it gave Flair a definitive victory, it kept Vader strong, and the crowd went nuts. So I'm not sure I can complain about it.
The same, it was a great go-home moment for the fans, clearly. And like you say, Vader wasn't buried or anything in this match. Like you say, he spent 80 minutes, for want of a better phrase, beating the piss out of Ric Flair. So from that, you knew that Flair was never going to have a Hogan-esque comeback and beat Vader down. It was going to be a sort of sneaky or out of the blue counter type finish, and it was. But like you say, you got Flair going home from the show as champion. Crowd are happy. You've got Vader still looking very strong as a heel, and the rematch here is inevitable. And based on this, it's something I'm pretty much looking forward to.
Yeah, no, I can't disagree. And we're going to come to our interview awards a bit later on, so we'll certainly. Probably, I'm sure we'll come back to this match, certainly partially. But your overall thoughts and a score rating on this show?
I'm struggling to really give this much more than a 4, to be honest. Vader and Flair came very close to saving it. I mean, very, very close. The fact that I'd probably give their match a good 4.5 out of 5 shows that just how much that match
Can we work on one scoring system here? Because you want to give the show 4 out of 10 and the match 4.5 out of 5.
Oh, sorry. Oh, no, sorry. I'd give...
Give the match 9, that'll help.
Yes, that's probably the best way, yes. I'd give the match a 9 out of 10, but the overall card about 4 out of 10. Sorry.
That's fine. I mean, that's all right. I just want to clarify in case everyone thought, well, is he giving the show 8 out of 10 then?
In fact, I'll make it easier. I'll give the overall... their match a 9 out of 10, and I'd give the overall card a C. Does that clear things up a bit?
Oh yeah, clear as mud. Thanks very much. It's funny because I've read a lot of reviews of this show since it's happened, and everyone's kind of saying, everyone's kind of detaching the main event from the rest of the card, which, while fair enough, it's like, well, if you're going to give the show an overall rating, I think you've got to rate it as a whole. And I'm as flat as the rest of the the show was, I'm inclined to just give the show an 8 out of 10 just because of how good the main event was. It's like, well, okay, maybe they had to sit through 2 hours of wrestling that wasn't great and could have been better, but it was okay. It wasn't bad. I've seen, hey, I sat through Battle Ball. Anything looks good after that. But you had a decent undercard and the main event was brilliant. And it's like, I think to give it any less than an 8 would be to undercut Vader and Flair. I thought this was a fantastic match. And it showed by accident, by hook or by crook, and we're going to talk about this in a bit as well, is that just how strong, like, WCW's options are if they're smart enough to use them correctly.
Yes.
And this, I thought was, as I say, to call it any less than a very good show would be wrong just because of how good the main event was. Let's move into the WWF. We're obviously building towards their next pay-per-view, which is the Royal Rumble. As I mentioned in the news, the current card is looking like this. Yokozuna against The Undertaker in a casket match for the WWF title. The Royal Rumble match itself, Razor Ramon against IRS, the Intercontinental title, and Bret and Owen Hart against the Quebecers. In terms of the storylines leading into this, Craig, I mean, they've been building kind of the tension between Bret and Owen, although they haven't had a showdown yet on Raw, but they've kind of had them both kind of talking about it, and Owen's, you know, becoming the jealous, quote unquote, jealous younger brother. And so it would appear at least that that match has been put together for them to kind of formally break up, and to build that going forward. And how do you think that angle's going, and how do you think it's, what prospect do you think it has in terms of what match they could have at the Rumble?
I quite like it. The family stuff's good. I mean, you see the tag team dissension in the ranks, splitting up time and time again, but it's a little bit different and less seen that when it involves actual family members. So it sort of marks that as being a little bit different. In terms of the match, I mean, I would imagine Owen will turn on Bret and cost them the match. Sort of what, maybe even just walk away from a tag if Hart's in a bit of bother or something like that. That's what I would see. But in terms of a program going forward, it's a little bit weird though, because I mean, you've got Bret that's pretty much near the top of the roster, and Owen's just not in that sort of same position. So I'm not, I don't know how a feud will work. I mean, if anything, it's going to bring Owen up, but they do just seem on very different pages as it stands.
Yeah, I mean, I agree in the sense that, you know, I mean, not that it would make sense if they weren't brothers, but I think in the sense that if you were looking at them individually without their relationship to each other, you would certainly say that Bret is a lot higher up on the card than Owen. But I think it's a story because they are brothers and it's a family story. I think it's a story that people will be able to invest in easily enough, where you could imagine that Owen, maybe, you know, knowing Bret better than anyone else, might be able to use some tricks or some knowledge that nobody else has got to beat him and that kind of thing. So I don't think it's too much of a stretch that you could put over the idea that Owen could compete with Bret, and then with the idea that ultimately that feuding with Bret with a win or a loss at the end of it would kind of elevate him a little bit.
Yeah.
Let's look at, the WWF Championship match. Yokozuna against The Undertaker. Hasn't received a ton of build yet, on Raw, but I mean, they kind of alluded to it at SummerSlam with the double count out. Is this match going to be any good? I mean, it is a casket match, which is an interesting dynamic, but does that not point towards Undertaker winning?
It certainly hasn't, lost one yet. So the choices are either Undertaker wins or Yokozuna wins v cheating. That seems to be the obvious way the obvious outcomes here. Unless it's either a Taker title win or Yokozuna gets help to retain the belt.
Yeah, I mean you would think that based off what we know about Yokozuna probably being in the main event at WrestleMania against Lex Luger, and we'll come on to that in a minute. You would think that Yokozuna would retain the title, but as you say, if Yokozuna wins by nefarious methods, you would think that Undertaker would get a rematch at WrestleMania. That would be the logical, well, not WrestleMania, given that obviously he wouldn't be in the Royal Rumble. But you think he would get a rematch at some stage?
That would certainly be the obvious next stages. So I guess whatever happens, it's going to keep the Undertaker in that field, but who knows?
Yeah, and Razor Ramon against IRS. I mean, that is an odd one in the sense that Shawn Michaels is back now. He's officially, at least, he's the self-proclaimed Intercontinental Champion in the sense that that's what he's saying. They're saying that, no, we strip you of the title. Razor Ramon is the champion. They're both currently carrying belts. You would think that the logical match here would be Razor Ramon against Diesel. If you were going to kind of build your way into Razor against Shawn at WrestleMania. But Razor against IRS, given that they've done relatively little with IRS since Ted DiBiase's left, feels like a bit of an odd one.
It certainly does nothing for me. I think the last 12 months, Ramon certainly improved. I thought he looked very green at the 93 Rumble. But now he looks like a solid mid-carder. And you're right, just when Million Dollar Man left, I just envisaged IRS bumbling about for a bit, then being jobber to the stars and then leaving. So for him to still be getting a title shot, put 6 months down the line. Let's be honest though, I don't think anyone, even IRS, would imagine that he would win this match.
No. And then the Rumble match itself, I mean, reports that Lex Luger's going to win it, but as we discussed before, you would figure they would have given up on Lex Luger by now.
You would have thought so. Bret Hart's certainly been getting the better reaction from the crowd, but I think Vince is adamant that he wants the new All-American, All-Conquering Hero, so...
Which I guess begs the question, why not give him the title at SummerSlam? But we covered that back in August.
Yes, indeed.
But, I mean, if not Luger, I mean, you know, they can always break their own rules and throw someone like Bret Hart in there to win the match or The Undertaker. But, you know, if we assume that the Rumble winner isn't going to be wrestling at any other point on the card, if not Luger, who else could it be?
You're right. It's difficult to look beyond Luger. Although that does put it in the good position of, if it is someone else but Luger, that's a surprise. And
yeah.
Surprises are always good.
I mean, like, the two names that come to mind, one was Davey Boy Smith. Well, actually three names. One, Davey Boy Smith, who's just left WCW. Although that'd be a left turn, I would say, in the road if it was Davey Boy against Yokozuna. Mm-hmm. Because Yokozuna's been playing off the anti-American thing. You probably wouldn't put him against the Brit at Mania. Hulk Hogan, but there's that. And the other one was Sid Vicious, for what that's worth. Those are the kind of three guys that came to mind. It's starting thinking, well, they're all at least available. But yeah, it's an interesting one, but it's one that isn't easy to predict. And so, you know, I presume they go with Luger, I would think. I don't know why.
No. Just try to stretch it out. Just try to give him the legitimacy of having won the Rumble. It's the only thing that you'd imagine the WWF thinking being that the fans might see. Oh, well, he's won the Rumble. He's clearly something. But of course, as we know, he's not really much at all.
No. And then kind of looking ahead to WrestleMania in terms of, as I say, you would imagine that a lot of these feuds will advance forward. So I'm guessing we're looking at Bret against Owen. That kind of makes sense. That's pretty easy to build. Razor against Shawn. That makes sense. Crush against Randy Savage that we've not mentioned yet that they're kind of slowly building to. And then Yokozuna probably against Lex Luger. But the big question I've got is, where does Undertaker fit in amongst all this? I mean, okay, he's in the title match, so I guess he could win the title and then they could do Undertaker against, well, anyone really, win the Rumble. But if not, I mean, the best name I can come up with is Ludwig Borger.
That would make sense, because we did discuss the notion of, Yokozuna retaining through nefarious means. So sticking Undertaker against X person that helped Yokozuna retain the title would make sense. I would have thrown out maybe even someone like Crush, actually, because with the Yokozuna and Crush being aligned, you can't rule out the idea of Crush, helping Yokozuna. So that would be something. But yeah, no, you're right. There aren't many obvious candidates, but it's probably going to be someone that helped Yokozuna retain.
Yeah, I mean, there's, I guess kind of one idea they could go down would be maybe, as you say, kind of flip that over, the Undertaker against Crush and then Randy Savage against Yokozuna.
Yeah,
which isn't necessarily the worst idea, although I don't get the sense they want to put Randy Savage that close to the WWF title. But anyway, we're speculating, and I guess we will wait and see. But again, it's obvious to a point, and yet Undertaker's their biggest guy, and well, we don't know. But anyway, we'll also be reviewing the Royal Rumble next month, and all that comes with that. And I think it's fair to say that at the end of the Royal Rumble, we'll have a far clearer idea of where we're going to be going into WrestleMania. And speaking of obviously Royal Rumble, you know, next year, technically, let's do our end of year awards. Now obviously before we go into this, it is worth caveating that this project only really started in May, the podcast only started in August. And so one award that we will probably do next year, which is Show of the Year, we're not going to do because we haven't had a chance to see it. And also that all of the awards we are doing, I think to be fair, we're only going to based on the period of time that we've covered, because yes, you can go back and watch previous shows, but we wouldn't be able to cover them in the same way or with the same context. So I think with that in mind, basically it's kind of going to be stuff since August. There's going to be the odd mention. There was a great Shawn Michaels Marty Jannetty match on Raw from the beginning of July, which we'll probably come up to. But we'll start with rest of the year. We'll start with the big one. Craig, I mean, the names I've got listed here, Vader, Ric Flair, Bret Hart, Yokozuna, Jerry Lawler, and Cactus Jack. Is there anyone else that sticks out to you that could be in that discussion?
Not terribly. I picked someone off that list as my wrestler of the year. So I'm not in a position to nominate someone else for this.
No, I mean, there are guys that are more over that we probably wouldn't put in this list. Undertaker's more over than guys on that list. Sting's certainly more over than guys on that list. But no, I think in terms of their achievements across the period of time that we're looking at, I think that's good. I mean, I don't want to go blow for blow on all of them, but I mean, in terms of there's three guys from each side. In terms of the WWF lot, Lex Luger's not on that list, but I don't think he should be, in the sense that he's kind of fan perception relative to how much he pushed just wasn't good enough. I think that's probably fair to say.
And I think absolutely. I think Bret Hart's on that list in spite of Lex Luger. You could almost argue that whilst Luger's the one that's been essentially rammed down our throats, be it through sit-down interviews or bus tours, that it's Bret Hart that the crowd are seem to be rooted behind, which makes you, which gives you a little bit more faith in the wrestling world after the torrid start to 1993 that the Hitman had.
Yeah, in terms of kind of his run, I mean, obviously, it almost kind of counts against him and Lawler that we didn't get the blow off to that feud. And I think that probably rules them both out, in the sense that, as you say, Hart had ultimately a pretty mixed year. I mean, okay, he won King of the Ring and he had an excellent performance there.
Absolutely.
But I think in terms of the stuff on the whole, the stuff at the end of WrestleMania 9, with him losing the match to Yokozuna and then Hulk Hogan winning the belt. Hulk Hogan's a name that's not on this list, but I think given that he left in June and July, invalidates him even if we were doing a year long review. But I think if for the sake of argument, if we put one forward from each WCW and WWF, I would probably, I mean, Yokozuna's an interesting one, because, I mean, we're saying rest of the year, not in terms of purely in-ring work, but in terms of, you know, Yokozuna hasn't been great, but, I mean, I don't think he's necessarily been given greatness to work with. You know, Luger would have bought out more in Yokozuna had Luger have been more over. Is Yokozuna in this discussion?
I don't know, he's just, he's at the top of the mountain, but he's not really done a terrible amount other than being the sort of the champion, to be honest. I mean, I'm sure he's got the program with Undertaker, but I think since winning the title at King of the Ring, his run's been quite flat, to be honest. So I'm despite him being WWF champion, I have a great deal of difficulty in including him in this.
Your pick from those three?
I would put forward Bret Hart.
Yeah, I think I would as well, just.
Yeah.
His performance of King of the Ring was excellent. Good story going with Owen. Probably would have gotten more had he been able to finish that feud with Lawler. But yeah, I agree. I think Yokozuna has been top of the mountain, but he's kind of been top of the mountain while they've tried to get Luger over. He's kind of been the second part.
Yes.
WCW argument is a lot more tricky, I would say. I mean, Cactus Jack, I mean, we're going to come to what one of the categories I've got on this list is the worst thing of the year. And Cactus Jack's mini movies is very near the top of that list. He hasn't always had greatness to work with, as we saw with the tag match here at Starrcade. He was just kind of thrown out there with three guys that I don't think are kind of remotely in his league. But at times this year, we've seen how good he can be. And I think I go back to that match in October at Halloween Havoc with Vader, which we covered it in full detail there. But I think, long story short, showed how versatile he is and how brilliant he is. I look at Ric Flair, who, again, hasn't always had greatness to work with. You know, that stuff with, he had a couple of long matches with Rick Rude, which weren't as good as I think they should have been. But again, Flair at times has been very good, and as we saw with the main event. But I think the guy who's going to stick out for me, and I'll let you cover him as well as the other two guys, is Vader.
You won't ever get an argument over Vader being awesome from me, so I'm happy to sign up for that.
In terms of the other two, rating kind of there, 1993s?
Okay. Jack's like the opposite of the, sorry, comparable with Hart. I mean, he's had sort of rubbish thrown at him, and he still managed to just continue just to pull himself above anyone else that he gets put in the ring with.
I don't think Bret Hart was ever thrown those mini movies. I don't think. If we're going to give one of them the award for well done, you salvaged that, we're definitely giving it to Cactus Jack.
Oh no, exactly, but then Cactus Jack wasn't forced to drop a title and see Hulk Hogan winning it 30 seconds later, so...
That's true.
We were just talking about rubbish being thrown, that's it. You're right, it's different levels of rubbish, but he had those mini movies, the amnesia angle, all that nonsense. And you're right, he still manages, like the tag match at Starrcade, there's four guys in there, three of them are pretty rough to be fair, and he manages to stand out from them entirely through his own work. So, yeah, Cactus Jack's had a very good year.
Flair? Ric Flair?
Yeah, don't know. I mean, it's difficult, obviously, to look beyond the importance of Flair. I'd probably give Flair the number two position out of the three, to be honest. But ultimately, it's still going to be Vader for me that gets that nod.
Yeah, it really is hard to disagree with Vader in terms of these three, or in terms of comparing him to Bret Hart or any of the other guys. I mean, his ability in the ring for a guy his size, I'm going to come to that later, is exceptional. Two, his ability to put on a very good match. Okay, I think, yeah, we saw at Halloween Havoc and at Starrcade that he might not be the most versatile guy, although he can do a Vader bomb, so, you know, for what that's worth. But, you know, I think his ability to wrestle that brawling, heavy-hitting, convincing style of match, you know, he's almost one of the things where he's a believable heel in terms of that you think he would beat you up, but he's in no means like a cool heel or a heel that you want to get behind, and part of that is due to how good Harley Race is as well.
Uh-huh.
I just think he ticks all of the boxes.
Yeah, he's the classic monster heel. He'd be, I would imagine, an awful face, but he is that.
Oh God, he'd be a terrible face, wouldn't he?
Absolutely abysmal.
Yeah.
Absolutely terrible. Because you would never be able to buy into the sympathy aspect of Vader, because that would involve him getting beaten down. And
I was going to say, imagine the reverse match of what we saw earlier this month, with Ric Flair beating up Vader for 18 minutes, and then Vader getting the crowd pop and the big thing at the end. It wouldn't work.
You just think he was rubbish, yeah. If you saw Vader getting beaten up, you wouldn't think... you wouldn't get sympathy for him. You would just think
you would think how heroic. Guy. Yeah, you think he'd just be terrible.
He doesn't have the sort of look that has gotten guys over his faces either. No, the sort of clean cut image that we'll see time and time again is the face. He doesn't have that. He's perfectly suited to being a monster heel, and adding someone like Harley Race into the mix only makes things better, in my opinion.
My vote for the rest of the year goes to Vader. I take it yours does as well.
Is it that obvious?
Well, yeah. All right, well, that goes in. The Wrestling 20 Years Ago podcast Wrestler of the Year for 1993 is Vader. So we'll see how that develops. Let us move on to the quote-unquote non-wrestling act of the year. Now, this is basically anyone else who's appeared on television, a manager, a valet, a commentator. Todd Pettengill, I'm sure you're going to push forward. But yeah, I mean, the guys, I've got three names on this list, well, not all announcers, but they've all announced. Bobby Heenan, Jim Cornette, and Jesse Ventura are the three names that stick out for me. Anyone else stick out for you?
You laughed when you mentioned his name, but I do quite like Todd Pettengill. I genuinely do quite like Todd Pettengill.
I know you like Todd Pettengill, but you're not seriously putting forward as the non-wrestling act of the year, are you?
No.
Good.
No, I mentioned him earlier on when we were talking about Starcade. I can't go beyond Ventura. Ventura is just a genius calling matches. He adds another dimension to the story that's being told in the ring. So two guys could be telling a great story in the ring, and he'll bring it up an extra notch. So for me, it's difficult to look past Ventura. And I love a wrestling manager. I really, really do. But the role of a manager seems slightly diminished in the world of wrestling in 1993. I mean, I seem to be having a bit of a love-in with him tonight. But you see Vader, and he's got a Harley Race, but that Race is really the best, in my opinion, manager out there, but Ventura gets the nod.
Shall we mention Harley Race in all this? I mean,
he'd be my number two.
Yeah, that's fair. I mean, Ventura has been very good on commentary. As I say, even like the small stuff with kind of getting over how William Regal didn't have to win the match, he just had to not lose it. I thought that was quite nice, and he does. I think he treads the line between being sarcastic. I'm not criticising Bobby Heenan here, but I think Ventura, in terms of being a believable and respectable or authoritative colour commentator, treads the line slightly better between having those funny moments and those jokes and those laughs, and yet being able to turn it on and kind of dial it up better than Bobby Heenan does. I think Bobby Heenan is great at what he does, and I'm not suggesting for a second that I'm slighting his work, but I think if we're going to compare the two, I think Ventura is better in those big matches.
Yes.
I didn't really think about who I was going to vote for. I mean, Jim Cornette's another interesting one, as I think is Harley Race as well. I mean, Cornette has only really been on our screen since kind of August, September, when he arrived with the Heavenly Bodies, and obviously he's been aligned with Yokozuna. I mean, cut a couple of very good promos, which is no surprise to Jim Cornette. But again, I don't think his contribution has quite been significant enough to get a mark in this category. And Harley Race, I mean, again, maybe we dismissed him a bit too quickly, in the sense that as good as Vader is, I think Harley Race adds a good couple of points to his act.
I think so. In that classic sort of, you take a guy that's maybe not the best speaker, best cutter of promo, and you give him someone that is, and someone that can then that can take his own skills and add those skills to make him a guy better. That's one of the roles of a manager, and that's one that Race does very, very, very well.
Yeah, I think we're both going to go on the same lines again. I think I'm going to go with Jesse Ventura.
Same.
Okay, we'll put that down. We will disagree at some point, I'm sure. Right, okay. Next category of the year, the flop / fail of the year. I need a better name for this. Any ideas, tweet us in. But basically, just anyone who failed, who disappointed, who was, as we spoke about Lex Luger, didn't get over to the degree that their push suggested they should have done. So it's quite a wide-ranging category. The five names I've got listed, Lex Luger, Sid Vicious, Rick Rude, perhaps a little bit unfairly, but we'll come to that in a minute, Ludwig Borger, and, interestingly enough, Hulk Hogan.
I thought Borger was slightly harsh as well, to be honest. I mean, he's not done much, but I don't think he's been terribly pushed to the hilt either. I mean, I appreciate it was in the main event of Survivor Series 93, but And I have obviously been very critical of the whole notion that his...
Didn't you say on last month's show that he didn't deserve a spot on the roster? Or am I making that up? I'll have to go back and listen to the tapes on that. Maybe you did. But no, I kind of agree. I think I'm kind of with Rude as well. Because, I mean, Rude in part in the sense that he hasn't necessarily flopped. It's just that I think a guy as good as he has done should have been involved in some bigger things. Does that make sense?
Yeah. What I was going to say about Borga is that he is by far the worst ever anti-American character. His whole stance is, as I pointed out before, based on environmental concerns and educational attainment. That is dreadful.
It's different.
No, it's not.
It is dreadful, but it's a different spin on things rather than just I'm anti-American for the sake of it.
Yeah, but no, but the genuine stuff sort of during the Cold War of the Russians against the Americans, that at least generates heat. But with Borga, it's just like, what's our problem with Finland again? It's the same way, like, Crush. It's just like, I'm sure...
That's the first time that sentence has been uttered in history. What's our problem with Finland again? A very valid point.
So that's my sort of main problem with Borga. But I don't think that he can be considered a flop because I don't think that they've thrown the full...
They've not given him the chance to flop.
Yes.
I think quickly on Rick Rude, I mean, I made these notes a couple of weeks ago. Would you say he's probably more disappointed than flopped?
Yeah, he's gonna end the year thinking, I've not had the best 1993, but I wouldn't say it's a disaster, because he's ending the year as a champion, albeit a champion the holder of a title that...
Doesn't really mean anything anymore.
Yeah, but...
And he has been a little unlucky, and we spoke about the Clash of Champions match last month against Rogue Warrior Hawk that lasted 6 minutes. Three of those was posing, the other three was them both being injured.
Yes.
And then this month, should have been wrestling Davey Boy Smith, but Davey Boy Smith leaves, so he has to wrestle the boss. A couple of matches with Ric Flair that I think, given the time and given how good Ric Flair is, probably should have been better. But again, yeah, I think he's probably disappointed. I mean, let's move on to, I think, the three bigger names. I mean, Hogan is an interesting one here. I mean, okay, he, in terms of what I said about the awards, he doesn't really fit into this category given that the project only really started around the time he left. So maybe I might have to almost disqualify him for that. But in terms of, if we go back and look at his contributions that year, of the year for 93, I mean, would he merit in this discussion, given that he got a spot in the WrestleMania, ultimately the main event that he probably didn't warrant, and then had a largely disappointing match against Yokozuna, and that was it. It wasn't a flop, it was just more of a massive disappointment.
If you judge it based on what he gave back to how much he took in terms of money, I would certainly, it'd be difficult to argue against him being a flop. I imagine Vince pulled out the checkbook and wrote quite a considerable amount of money to tempt him back. So for what Vince would have gotten out of things, he would certainly definitely be in the running. But for me, it has to be the guy that Vince tried to turn into Hogan's replacement, Lex Luger. I mean, pushed to the hilt. Has anyone ever been given as much as Luger has to get him over? You had the slamming Yoko on the Intrepid, the bus tour, everything like that. Sure, he was obviously hurt by the baffling finish to the 93 SummerSlam main event, but ultimately he's not been able to build that connection with the crowd. It's that classic case of taking a heel or a face that no one really cares about and turning him and expecting that to be enough. It's not been enough. It's a heel. Fans weren't really bothered. He was a lower mid-card heel that just couldn't connect, and now he's a face that connects marginally more, but still not enough to really consider him a success. So I have a very great deal of difficulty in not putting Luger forward for this one.
No, I agree with almost everything you've said. I mean, the one thing I'd maybe, and I probably am going to agree with you on this, but the one thing I'd probably say is that how much of this was his fault in terms of, you know, he got put in the position, the turn didn't really make sense. It was kind of just, well, he was a heel, he was, you know, the king of the ring, he was the narcissist, he was looking himself in the mirror, and then just turned on the Intrepid for no real reason. And then, he should have won the match at SummerSlam. We're going to look back on that, you know, down the line and just still be baffled by it. Because he should have won that match. And it's like, okay, you look at the SummerSlam show, and I remember back to that show, the crowd weren't that hot for him. The crowd wasn't that hot for the main event as a whole, as has been for Survivor Series as well. Undertaker was more over. But he should have won that match. And it's like, yes, he's probably going to end up going to be our flop of the year, but they almost assign as much of that blame to the people who didn't book in to win that match as him himself, because he's not been great. And I think in terms of, even if he had won that match, I think he still would have disappointed. But if you don't give a guy a chance to get over in the way that they were trying to push him, can you really blame him when he doesn't?
I was going to say that if he had won that match, we might have been discussing him as Wrestler of the Year. You never know. But in the end, the main event at SummerSlam just kicked the legs from under him. If he'd been given a nod to win the title, you don't know what he would have done as champion. You don't know how well he'd have run with it if he'd been given that ball. But he wasn't. So now we're discussing him as the flop. And you're right. It is unfair on Luger based on the fact that he isn't the booking department, but the booking team didn't clearly have enough faith in him to give him the nod, and here we are talking about him winning
the Royal Rumble. Possibly.
It's just baffling. It's really baffling. I mean, what is going on? Is he the man? Isn't he the man? How many times does he get a chance to show he is the man? And I mean,
we are doing end of year awards, so I won't look forward a lot, just to say that, you know, if he is going to win the Rumble, I mean, he did win the match at SummerSlam. They did do the ticker tape and the flags and the pyro. The Steiners came out. He was the sole survivor in the match at Survivor Series. If he wins the Royal Rumble match and then finally gets his big moment at WrestleMania, it could still work. I don't think it will, but it could. The other guy I think we should mention as well is Sid Vicious. I think possibly flop. You could give him this award in a different way, in the sense that how spectacularly everything ended, and thankfully Arn Anderson and he are okay. You know, in that regard. But I think, you know, he was in that position, and there was the whole thing where they put him alongside Vader in the middle months in the middle. But I think the idea that that Sid would have been the guy is horrendous, I think. When you think about what actually happened at Starrcade, it's quite hard to believe he wasn't. But I think in terms of flop of the year, you could almost give him the award in a different way. But I don't think he was as bad as Luger.
I think you could say if we had a drops the ball award, I think it would certainly be him, because he's went from main eventer to being fired due to his own stupidity. But in terms of flop, I don't think he's a flop. I think he's just been an idiot.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Well, Idiot of the Year award goes to Vicious. But yeah, I think we've both argued quite compellingly, and I don't think anyone could disagree on this, that Lex Luger is most definitely the flop of the year.
It would have been Hogan had we done the full 12 months, but based on the remit of these awards, Luger, yes.
Yeah. Let's look at the next category is quote unquote rising star of the year. Again, this is, there's kind of a few different ways you could look at this, like the brightest prospect, or, yeah, the best debut, or even like the most improved. But the list, I come up with, four names here, and I think this is one way you could actually have quite a few. The names I've got are the 1-2-3 Kid, Razor Ramon, Too Cold Scorpio, and an interesting one from left field from ECW in Sabu, who we haven't spoken about much at all, and we are going to do more ECW in the coming months on the show. That almost probably kind of hurts Sabu in terms of him winning this award. But any, I'm assuming this is the award that you might have some more options for.
Absolutely. I think there's certainly a case for each of them. I wouldn't be terribly disappointed if any of the four won. I could see the reason behind any of them taking this award. But for me, it's got to be Razor Ramon. I touched on it earlier on. At the 93 Rumble, he was put into the title match against Bret Hart, and he just seemed the greenest guy ever in that position. But a year down the line, he looks like a really, really solid mid-carder. But the best bit of evidence of how he's been able to get himself over is at the start of his match at Survivor Series, when he takes the mic to introduce Savage and he does the Listen to Me promo, and the place goes absolutely nuts, and you almost see the look of surprise in his face. So yeah, for me, it's got to be Ramon.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think one of the most interesting things that also they've turned in face alongside one of the guys we're going to talk about in a minute in the 1-2-3 Kid. But I mean, this was a character, clearly, you know, it was a heel. He's called the bad guy, but you can't get much more black and white than that. But it's not only worked as him being a babyface, it's worked really well. It shouldn't have worked as well as it did, but I think that's kind of a testament to how well he's done in the role, that he's taken a character that isn't really built for being a babyface and made it pretty convincing.
Yeah, I mean, he's the guy from Scarface, essentially. So you're right, he has no place at all being a face, but it's entirely through his own work and the fact that, and we touched on the idea of building a connection with a crowd earlier on, he's been able to build that connection. The fans care, the fans pop when his music hits. They go wild when he wins. They see him as a credible champion.
If he got Lex Luger push, not obviously the same push, because he wouldn't have changed the character like that, but if we're going to talk about Lex Luger's overall overness, if that's a word, relative to his push, if Lex Luger's down 4 or 5 points, Razor Ramon's up 2 or 3, I would say, in terms of he was only pushed so far, but he's made so much of it.
Yes, that's absolutely correct. I mean, ahead of the Royal Rumble 93, we just seemed a thrown together match, but he is totally over, and with a sizable push, he would be able to do something, because he has, whilst he's not got the sort of roided up muscle head size that Luger has, he's still a big guy. He's not sort of like your traditional your middleweight Intercontinental Champion. He's a big guy. He's a tall guy. So, I mean, if the WWF wanted to give him the ball, give him the chance to run with it, he'd be able to do pretty well, I would think.
Well, we spent about 3 or 4 minutes talking about Ramon, but for the sake of balance, at least, I think we'll go through some of the other nominations.
I think we've decided, yes.
Yes. Let's talk about the 1-2-3 Kid. I mean, came on as just, you know, enhancement talent, and clearly, you know, it wasn't a case of him having a breakout match for his own. They booked him in that with that surprise victory against Razor Ramon, of all people. But again, I think in terms of a guy who has a lot of limitations, you know, he sounds and looks like a 15-year-old boy, and he can't be that much older. No. But I think in terms of one, a guy who hasn't been given a lot, but again, it has done a lot with the opportunities that he's had, and they're in a position now where he'd need the right opponent, and maybe he'd be better in a tag team or having someone who basically could talk for him, because, yes. or kind of be put against almost kind of like the Bret Hart Jerry Lawler feud, in terms of Lawler is the heel doing all of kind of the legwork in the build up. In terms of Lawler's doing the talking and the bullying, and then it gets to the match, and Bret, not that Bret is as bad a talker as the 1-2-3 kid is by any stretch.
No, but I know what you mean.
I think you could, if you worked him with the right opponents or worked him with the right partners, I think you can get a lot from him.
I think after puberty, the 1-2-3 kid might be a different guy.
Yeah.
But yes, no, I totally take what you mean. And it's been a great and well-told story of the underdog. I mean, no one expected the kid to be going over in this one. I mean, on PW Torch, you've had Wade Keller talking a lot about the guy that was formerly the Lightning Kid, and we've seen him, but he did just look like the classic guy that does quite well in the indies, comes in and looks like a jobber, and that's what it looked like in the early stages. But he got that fluky win, and then we saw him in some of the sort of bumps, and
well, he had that rematch about 3 weeks later and nearly killed himself with that top right bump as well.
Yeah, exactly. So he's taking bumps, and there's a place for that. Where he goes next, that's obviously very difficult to determine. The idea of a tag team makes sense, a heel doing the work or a manager, but I think the guy's clearly got a bright future, but I don't think he's had a long enough run for me to get the nod here. Well played to him for all that he's done so far, but maybe if he continues at this pace, then it's probably going to be difficult to look past him in 94, but right now it's...
Yeah, I mean, the other two names I mentioned, one was Sabu, and again, we have, I mean, I've watched enough of ECW and his kind of debuts in amongst that. I don't think he's done enough yet, because he only debuted a couple of months ago in this new character, and I think it has the potential to be something significant, given that, yes, you know, this kind of psychotic, barbaric, bring a guy out on a body ball with a muzzle on, unleash him like he's some kind of mutant freak, and he just, you know, unloads.
It's certainly different and shocking.
Yeah.
It's got that, and like you say, it's got a great deal of potential.
You almost wonder whether it's too ridiculous. That would almost kind of be my concern, is that they're going to have to tell a very intricate story with Sabu to make it almost a kind of a believable character.
Yeah, it's on the cusp of being OTT, without doubt. Yeah.
But it kind of has to be, otherwise I don't think it makes much sense. And the other guy on this list is Too Cold Scorpio, who I think I'm probably a bigger fan of than you are. That's not to say that you're necessarily down on him. I think his performances in very limited situations, he's in a tag match with Marcus Alexander Bagwell. They're in kind of the undercard of a lot of WCW events, and he's getting the hot tags, and he's doing all these moves, but I think in terms of, if we're going to talk about, if he had the kind of push the 1-2-3 kid did, in terms of just build his character a little bit, let him show off what he can do in singles action, I think he potentially going forward into 94, and I'm probably invalidating myself even nominating him here, I think him going forward next year could be a kind of breakout star for WCW, but I think he's had a good year, and I think he's, in the limited spots he's been given, he's done very well.
I have praised him in there. The past, I'm sure it was the last edition of this, when I talked about at least him and Bagwell have the same costumes for their tag team. They looked good in the ring, but ultimately he's only in the opening matches just now, so he's clearly being tested by the WCW. They want to see if he's got what it takes, but I'm, judging by his position on the card, I'm not convinced the powers that be think he's got it yet, and I'm erring on the side of caution myself, and would tend to agree with them on that analysis.
A vote for Razor Ramon?
Yes, it's very consensual so far, Bob.
Yeah, might we'll see. Maybe there'll be one or two. The worst thing of the year could be interesting. That's the one on the end.
I've got a funny feeling we're probably going to be in agreement on that, to be honest.
Well, I don't know. I sat through Battle Bowl, but we'll see. I mean, that was horrible. Anyway, tag team of the year. I've got three names listed down here. The Steiner Brothers, the Heavenly Bodies, and the Hollywood Blondes. Anything to add to that?
When the idea of the tag team of the year was first mooted, I went for the, I was thinking the Heavenly Bodies, but on consideration, I'm going for the Steiner, so I'm happy with this list, to be honest. And I think the problem with the Hollywood Blondes is, by the time we really got this going, you had Pillman with his injury, and they weren't teaming together, and then they split up. So I'd actually be arguing for not having Hollywood Blondes on this list.
Yeah, no, that's actually true. Again, that might be, I might have put them on there more relative to their 93 rather than the stretch of run we've done. Heavenly Bodies, I mean, they had a great match with the Steiners, and then had they faced the Rock and Roll Express, and I think we looked at it last month and kind of said, well, it was a good match. It was kind of a match in kind of a vacuum almost.
Yes.
And they've not really otherwise been featured, but I think, you know, we in the two kind of snippets we got of them, they did very well. But I think when you compare that to how good the Steiner Brothers have been consistently in terms of their matches on Raws and their matches on the pay-per-views and their matches, I think they had a match, one of my outside nominations for the match of the year coming up will be their match against Money Inc. on the SummerSlam Spectacular preview show. It's a cage match. But I just think in terms of two guys that are over, they're consistently putting on really good matches, and they're the workhorses of the WWF in terms of the tag team division, if not the whole lot, particularly while Phil Michaels had a kind of holiday in the middle of our run. I think the Steiner Brothers, by a distance, this is probably the easiest award to give in terms of they've just, and again, it's a little bit unfair in terms of the mechanics of the award and the Heavenly Bodies only really wrestled two matches. But the Steiner Brothers, I mean, you could make an argument for them being an overall act of the year, even versus Vader. They've been that good.
Yes, and the thing that stood out for me is just how different they are. in terms of their offense to what you usually get in the WWF in terms of tag teams. So yeah, I very much have difficulty disagreeing with the notion of the Steiners getting a nod for this one.
No, they get my vote and they get yours as well, I take it.
Yep.
Right, match of the year. Again, this is one of the easier ones in terms of this is one that, as much as we miss a lot of matches, we can at least analyse them all in isolation. I've got, how many matches have I got down here? I think I've got four. I've got Shawn Michaels and Marty Jannetty from Raw in July. That was really good. We didn't cover that because the podcast haven't started. That was a really good Raw television match for the Intercontinental title. The Steiners against the Heavenly Bodies from SummerSlam. That was another really good tag match. I think showed all four's ability. And then Vader against Cactus Jack from Halloween Havoc. As we went through in October, my reservations over the stipulation and the stuff going on outside the match are well documented, but that was a superb match. And then I think my fourth kind of pick in terms of the nominations obviously has to be the match between Vader and Ric Flair that we've covered earlier in the show.
Yeah, I'd agree. Vader and Flair definitely makes that shortlist. I take it we're discounting the four doinks against Bam Bam Bastion and the Head Shrinker from the Survivor Series.
Well, I mean, I think if we were allowing five matches on the card, we might have put that in. But no, I had forgotten about that match until you brought it up.
Sorry.
Yeah. in terms of the four matches, I mean, they're all very good. I mean, again, this is probably one of the more difficult awards to give, actually. I mean, I guess Michaels and, if we were trying to round it down, I think Michaels and Jannetty was very good, but it was just a Raw opener. It was a very good Raw opener, but it went 12 minutes. I don't think it had the levels of drama or even the levels of importance that maybe the Vader matches had as well. And I think kind of the Steiner match against the Heavenly Bodies was very good, but again, I don't think it was important enough to properly make this category. Would you agree in ruling out those two?
No.
Okay.
we finally got some dissension in the
round.
There
we go.
My match of the year, and I said it on the August show, I said that I'd have difficulty looking beyond Steiners and Heavenly Bodies for match of the year because I love tag team wrestling. And here we are, December 93, and I'm sticking by that. I just thought it was a standout tag team match. It was probably not to the same extent as Heavenly Bodies versus Rock and Roll Express at Survivor Series, but muting it benefits it slightly because whilst the crowd were behind the Steiners, they didn't really still yet care about the Heavenly Bodies, but they put on a good tag match, different offences. It didn't look like the sort of tag match you tended to get in the WWF, and for me, I can't betray my fondness for tag team matches, so I need to vote for this one. So that would be my match of the year.
More than okay. At least we disagreed on something. I'm fine with that. So your vote for match of the year and your kind of your award, because we can't really debate this. Your award for match of the year would be that match. I'm going to say no purely because I enjoyed. One thing I would like you to help me debate on really is kind of the two Vader matches we've had. I think in terms of trying to pick the better match out of those two is interesting because the build to the Vader Flair match, as we said earlier in the show, was fantastic. But I think if we're talking about bell to bell, the Vader Catches Jack match was excellent and probably a peg or two better than the Flair match.
I think so, but it was hurt by the stupid taser stuff at the end.
Oh God, yeah. No, it was.
That knocks a good mark or two off of that match.
No, you're completely right. But your vote for match of the year goes for the tag match. I'm going to nominate Vader against Flair, the match we had here. I thought, again, it wasn't it was very good, but it wasn't kind of the perfect kind of in-ring spectacle. But I think when you group in the build, the anticipation, the crowd, the importance, everything that goes with it, this has to be my match of the year. In terms of just everything that went with it, everything that was important about it, everything that goes towards a match of the year should be a match of this calibre, and it delivered.
Yeah.
So my nomination goes with that. And finally, we'll look at the quote-unquote worst thing of the year, for what that's worth. I mean, Craig, this could be any number of things, really. I just kind of filed this as a group thing together. And the stuff I've got on this list is that god-awful 4-on-4 doink tag match at Survivor Series, which was 10 minutes of my life I'm never going to get back.
Mm-hmm.
The Shockmaster debut, the Cactus Jack mini movies, slash just all the WWE mini movies are awful. And Battle Bowl, which I had to sit through. I mean, this could be any number of things, but what sticks out for you?
If it had been the full 12 months, I'd have went for Hogan and his win at WrestleMania 9, but it's difficult to look past the Shockmaster here for me. The thing for me with the Shockmaster is, as bad as the debut was, I still don't know what WCW hoped to get from the Shockmaster. It was a dreadful gimmick with a largely nothing guy, so I don't know what they'd expected, but what I imagine, though, didn't quite expect what they got from it. So it's difficult to look past the Shockmaster for me.
No, it really is. I mean, look, Battle Bowl was horrible. I mentioned it last month. It's just three terrible hours of wrestling. I don't know how you can possibly book a wrestling show to be that boring. But it wasn't... In terms of the overall grander scheme of things, it wasn't the worst thing. It was just bad. The Cactus Jack mini-movies were terrible. They were worse. But yeah, I just think, you know, I mean, part of me just thinks, well, the Shockmaster debut was so funny we could invalidate it from the award, given that it was almost more comical than it was terrible. But I just think, given how spectacularly it failed, to give this award anything other would be really wrong. It will stick out, and it's probably going to live long in the memory, just in terms of how bad it was. And who knows, it looks like WCW are trying to salvage something from this, for what that's worth. But yeah, my vote goes to the Shockmaster debut.
Yep, fine, I'm happy with that. I'm very much behind the Shockmaster being one of the worst things in wrestling, let alone just 1993.
Yeah, well, let alone wrestling. But yeah, no, we'll see. Anyway, that will conclude our awards anyway. As I say, it's, next year I think it'll be a bit better given that we can do a whole year, but I think on the whole, I mean, even if we can both look back at the stuff that went before, I mean, as you say, that Hogan might appear a bit more in it, but on the whole, I don't think we'd have disagreed on Vader, even given 12 months.
I don't think we'd have disagreed on Ramon either, considering where he's came from and where he is now. So I think it'd have largely been quite the same.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think the only one that might have been significantly different might have been Match of the Year, but that's stuff that happens in isolation.
Yeah.
So that's fine. We're going to kind of, as we did this back in August, and I kind of want to do some retrospective chats when we can. First thing I want to talk about really is kind of the state of both rosters, both, we can kind of look at this both from a viewpoint of from 1993 and with a viewpoint of retrospective mind. In terms of looking at it from a 1993 perspective, Craig, we've got two sets of rosters here. I think you would be quite difficult to argue that the WWF shows are more entertaining. They've got a very good crop of up-and-coming talent. But when you compare, I think you could probably say, in terms of talent-wise, WCW have got it, and I think it's probably a case of them that they're misusing it rather than a case of it's not there. But when you compare the main event clusters of talent. Okay, Davey Boy Smith just left WCW and Hogan left, not to compare Davey Boy and Hogan, but in terms of, it's at the end of 93, it's slightly different than maybe this argument would have been a few months ago. Well, you compare, however, Flair, Sting, Vader, Cactus Jack are to the four top names on the WWF right now, which is, what, Yokozuna, Luger, Bret Hart and Undertaker, I would say.
Uh-huh.
In terms of crowd reactions, it's not even close. I mean, it really isn't.
No, I think you're right, WCW have got a much stronger roster, and it's just bad booking decisions that sets them apart. I think both, though, are still quite top heavy. There is, in both promotions, whatever you think of the top four, there is still then a gulf between that four and the next four or five. I think that's fair to say. I don't think the next guy to step into the main event is entirely obvious in either promotion.
No, I mean, to throw out, well, Rick Rude probably in WCW is probably the guideline after that.
But then we've just talked about him being his flop of the year, so well, you see, true. But you see what I mean? There's a number of guys you can say, well, if you give them a solid showing on Raw or Saturday night, main event, Saturday, WCW Saturday Night for the next 2 or 3 months, winning strong, then they could be in there. But there's no one that, if those four guys fell under a bus from both promotions, you would notice that the next guys to take the next step up would be lagging.
It needs to be a big bus as well.
It'd have a lot of horsepower, that bus.
Yeah, I mean, I get the sense the bus would run into Vader and the bus would probably come off worse, but anyway, that's part of the point. But no, I think in terms of the state of the two rosters, I think I think in terms of talent, it's there on both sides, but I think when you look at it now, and the one thing, yeah, we're in retrospective chat now, so I can say this, but the one thing I've tried to do with this project really is not, and it is quite difficult in terms of not to be completely obvious with, well, look, it's quite clear that Austin was destined for greatness in 1993, when in reality it wasn't. I mean, there were people singing his praises. But I think when you look at the two sets of rosters, it's you have to look a lot harder to see the talent in Steve Austin than you would in a Shawn Michaels. Mainly because Michaels is, one, getting the opportunity to show much more of a personality than Austin is, and two, he's getting the chance to have these big, albeit mid-card, but big mid-card matches. And I think that's kind of true in a lot of cases, in that the WWF, you almost feel like moving forward into 1994 and beyond, they've got the kind of bullet points in place that could have a couple of guys pushed up the card. And also, and maybe it is also easier for the WWF to do this rather than WCW, is that you get the sense that it'd be a lot easier to advance some of those guys into the main event because it's a lot weaker.
Yeah, I think the WWF are laden down with potential breakout stars. There are more people that you think, when you look at the two rosters, that you think on the WWF side of things, that like, oh, they could make it. We've talked about if Razor Ramon continues it the way he's going, he could quite comfortably fit into the main event picture. You've got, 1-2-3 Kid, who could, I don't know, maybe look credible as someone challenging for the IC title, but over in, WCW, the roster's a little bit older, and there's no one jumping out as the very obvious breakout guy. I mean, I think a lot of that comes down to the notion that WWF is very much in a transitional period after the whole steroid stuff and everything. And
the departure of Hulk Hogan as well.
Yeah, well, I think that certainly ties into it. Haven't they shed a lot of the sort of very muscle-bound guys? And I think that they're having to look at through different avenues to get different talent in. And I think that talent looks... the talent that they're bringing in is not comparable to what they had before. I mean, how do you think a guy like the 1-2-3 Kid would fit into the late 80s WWF? He'd be getting destroyed in 30 seconds by people like the Ultimate Warrior or the Barbarian.
Until he was given the opportunity to beat Razor Ramon.
But he wouldn't, I can't see a situation where he'd been given that chance in the WWF in the late 80s. So that's the thing. It's a very transitional period, and it's a lot younger roster on average, I would imagine, that the WWF have got. So I think they've got the guys that you can look at and be like, oh, he might actually come on to a game next year. Whereas with WCW, a lot of those guys you expect more from. And we've talked about Rude being our flop of the year, but that's a guy that was Intercontinental Champion in WWF and had a series of matches with the Ultimate Warrior that didn't look shit. This is a guy that clearly is very good in the ring, and here we are discussing him as being a potential flop of the year. They've got a lot of guys that aren't delivering what they really could do.
No, I mean, again, I think you have to look harder, but I think if you look in the right places, there is talent on that WCW roster. And again, this is quite easy with hindsight, but I think even at the time, you would look at what was going on and you would say, how much upward mobility is there on that WCW side of things? Given that, okay, in theory at least, they were going to put Sid Vicious in that big spot, which would have been something a little bit different, even if it could have been an absolute train wreck, as it was the train wreck happened before it even started. But you do wonder whether, looking ahead into 94, where, well, okay, how could a Steve Austin or a Dustin Rhodes or a Too Cold Scorpio, is the, not system in place necessarily, but are the mechanics in place where it would be realistic to say that one of them could get that push that could lead them to a main event match. And you look at what's gone on, and it does kind of feel like a very closed system. Again, that is the sort of thing that you can say with hindsight quite easily, in the sense that all of the criticisms of later WCW was that they never really gave anyone a chance. But I don't even think that would be that ridiculous to say at the time, given that Ric Flair was just winning their main title. Okay, that was an audible. It was going to be Sid Vicious. But it doesn't... You know, you look at Cactus Jack, who could have been a guy who broke out in that year, was kind of given an opportunity, but he ends the year in a random tag match.
And you've also got on the roster, and remember this is 93, so 6 years after Ricky Steamboat had what is still widely considered the best ever WrestleMania match against Savage, you've got him languishing in the TV title picture. I mean, and then mid-80s, he was tearing down the houses in an NWA program against Ric Flair. It's only 8 years on from that sort of time frame. That's a guy that they could be using in the main event. Steve versus Flair, that's got a big match feel to it. I mean, I appreciate that Flair right now is looking like a face, so it's a face against face thing, and back then it still was largely something he didn't do, but that's got a big match feel to it. That's still going to draw in punters that maybe at the time during the NWA went to those 60-minute draw matches and were blown out of their mind. 8 years, 9 years down the line, they might think, I'd like to go and see those guys again. They've got the talent on the roster, but they're just not utilising the guys that they have at all. It's strange. If you take the two rosters, I'm pretty sure Vince McMahon would be happier having WCWs than he would be with his own.
Yeah, in terms of...
Short term, he would be.
I even think long term, well, sort of, obviously, it's not a great question to answer in the sense that it doesn't really make sense, but I think in terms of one, short term, you've got a lot of guys who are over. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, you've got Sting and Flair who you could get, you know, a good run out of. And there's the talent there, and it's difficult to watch from the outside, but I think if someone who had more of a let's look to the future in mind, there is a few guys in that roster who I think you could go, right, let's get a good character around him, give him 18 months, and he might be in a position where he could draw for us.
Yeah.
So I think that'd be interesting. Well, in retrospect, don't we get to Flair and Steamboat in 94?
Flair and Steamboat, do we?
Let's have a look. I will Google that.
I hope so, because... I mean, a lot of I've seen some of their NWA stuff, but a lot of it's consigned to house shows that weren't recorded. I'd like that. Let's be honest, Bob. If you put Steamboat and Flair in a wrestling ring right now, you'd still get a very good match.
Yeah, that's true. Let me have a look at this.
So 20 years ago. I'm pretty confident that, because I read Chris Jericho talking about when he had the run with Steamboat, that they were some of the best matches he's ever had.
Yeah, here we go. Heading into 94, Steamboat engaged in one last feud over the World Heavyweight title with longtime rival Ric Flair in a match which culminated at Spring Stampede. That's right. Because it did end, because he retires in 94. But anyway, this is the recorded version of us just chatting. Now in retrospective mode, we don't have to stay in character. But yeah, I mean, the other reason I brought this kind of retrospective chat up was to kind of look at what happens, kind of not going forward a few months, but kind of a few years, in terms of if you were to name kind of the five biggest guys on each side of the Attitude Era, or the Monday Night Wars, call them, brand them however you want. Yeah. I think, fair to say, on WCW side, you'd say Hogan, Scott Hall, Kevin Nash, Sting, and the number five one, I mean, would we say Ric Flair on the whole? I mean, him or Goldberg. I mean, Goldberg came a bit later.
Yeah.
But you look at that, Hogan was recently in the WWF. Diesel and Razor Ramon are in the WWF. Sting is in WCW, and if it's Flair, he's there. If it's Goldberg, he's playing football.
Yeah.
On the WWF side, we've got Undertaker, who's kind of in the Sting position of the guy who's still there. We've got Austin and Cactus Jack, who are the two guys who are currently in WCW. We've got mean, The Rock, who, a bit like Goldberg, is playing football, or will be. And then we're talking about guys like The Undertaker, who's the major Undertaker, Triple H, who ultimately will come through the WCW system, Chris Jericho, who will come through the WCW system, Kane, who's knocking about. When you look at kind of those two, and I'm generalizing here a little bit, but you look at the strengths of both Monday Night Raw rosters, half of it's with the other company, which is a really interesting, I think, when you look at it.
And then you take one of the guys that was, in my opinion, at the forefront of changing the WWF from the cartoon stuff to more edgier stuff, and that's Goldust. And right now he's languishing largely in the mid-card of WCW's Dustin Rhodes over the US title. I mean, for me, Starrcade featured a match that had two of the pivotal guys in that, in bringing about that Attitude Era fighting, and both of them would go under fundamental change from there to when they were in the WWE 1995-96 period.
Yeah, and even guys who were less significant. Vader has a run in WWF leaning in 1996-97. Sid Vicious has a run a similar time. Bret Hart goes to WCW. It is quite weird, but on the whole, all of the puzzle pieces are in completely the wrong place, which is... I don't know what that kind of says. Is it bad management? Because I know, like, the revisionist history suggests that the WCW names left because they were being misused, and Scott Hall and Kevin Nash left the WWF because they weren't getting enough money, as did Bret Hart. I don't get the sense it's quite that cut and dry. Quite. But I mean...
You look at Starrcade again, you've got Ted Schlesinger and Pierce. They ended up being the Godwins. If they'd transferred across as that sort of badass team, even if they'd moved to the WWF as the Southern Justice when they were Jeff Jarrett's henchmen, they'd have done a lot better. I mean, you're right, there's a lot of on both rosters that William Regal ended up being a guy a wee bit later on that, for me, is one of the big missed boats for the WWF, that they didn't take the chance with Regal and did a lot more with them. It's crazy. And it comes down to the idea of the competition there, that you could be in the WWF and think, like Hall and Nash, I'm not getting enough money, so I'll go to WCW. That's, what's the biggest thing that's lacking in wrestling just now.
And the only guy who invalidates the argument is the 1-2-3 kid, X-Pac 6, who ends up jumping across and back.
Yes.
And he was kind of, I know Wade Keller, having listened to him more recently, he's a guy who Wade Keller says is actually probably more important to the Attitude Era than the people give him credit for.
Probably, yeah.
I think Wade Keller overstates that a bit, but I think he's right to a degree. But
that,
no,
post-WrestleMania 14 promo, for example.
Yeah. But no, I think it is a fascinating time going forward. I think into 94. I mean, what is interesting about 94, not to undercut the project for the next year, is I think really, and again, we're retrospective chat now, is that I think the company to watch out for really is ECW, actually, on the whole. When you kind of think about, well, really, you know, Nitro doesn't come along till 95. And, you know.
Raw plods along, but
yeah, we've still got Diesel to get from where he is now to the WWF title in under 2 years, I think.
Yeah.
Which at this point feels like a stretch, although I guess given his size, it shouldn't be that much.
No.
But I think looking forward, when you look at it, it's almost like what could have been for both companies, really, in the sense that the Monday Night Wars happened. But when you look at it from this point of view, none of it was by design. None of it, you can't sit here and look at 93 and go, yeah, there's a few puzzle pieces in place. None of it, looking ahead, makes sense, really, in terms of, okay, well, yeah, one of the main drivers of the Monday Night Wars was Ted Turner giving Eric Bischoff, you know, the license to go against Raw on Monday night. But the guys that were involved, they're all with the other company, which I think is fascinating in part, and I think is also telling that, you know, a lot of people talk about how, you know, we could have another wrestling boom period. I think when you look at the circumstances surrounding the first one, given how a lot of it was just luck and chance and happenstance, you look at all that, it kind of feels like, yeah, this is an odd situation.
Uh-huh. No, you're absolutely right on so many levels. It is a really crazy period. Like I touched upon, the idea that it's a transitional period with the WWF. Maybe things didn't work. They thought guys were the right guys, and you, they could, they probably, if they'd saw more in Nash and Ramon, they'd have offered them more money. If hindsight's the greatest thing in the world, I mean, if Vince McMahon had known that them pair were going to form the NWO and revolutionise wrestling,
he would have paid them a bit more money.
Of course he would. Yeah, exactly. But no, it's crazy. And I mean, we'd see, especially through sort of like people like your Ben Maas and your Jericho's, the WCW would slip through the net, end up playing such a pivotal role in the WWE.
The more you talk about it, the more it's like, what the hell was going on? Like, all of these guys were so important, everyone was let go.
Yes, exactly.
But anyway, the final part of today's show, it's going to be talking about fat men, or big men. Anyway, I think, yeah, again, you know, as two bigger guys ourselves, maybe it would be remiss
less,
to...
Less felt, I think we could diplomatically call it.
Less athletic.
Yes,
Although I am significantly thinner than I was when I started this show. There is that. But no, I think, you know.
Soft muscle.
Yes. Well said. But I think, you know, we're talking about Vader in terms of how great a year he's been. In terms of big guys, the reason I say fat is not derogatory. I think it just better defines the discussion in the sense that I sent you a list of names and you said, where's Andre the Giant? And I said, well, I wouldn't really call him. I don't really fit him in the same description in that he was just really big. In terms of a guy who's had an overhang, shall we say, is Vader is right up there, but is he the best big fat wrestler of all time?
I spent a lot of time thinking about this today, and for me, it's either Vader or Bam Bam. I think both of them displayed a level of athleticism that they shouldn't have been able to. But for me, it just edges it. So and I encourage all listeners to check this out. So I checked out a video quite recently of Vader and Bam Bam actually teaming to take on Doom, Soviet and Ron Simmons in Japan. And it's just fantastic stuff. Two big guys doing a lot more than they should be able to do in the ring. It's just really, really funny, but Vader.
Yeah.
It's been a Vader loving for me, but yes, it's Vader. In my eyes, is the best fat man, as you eloquently put it, and I would agree with that. But in my opinion, he's certainly in the reckoning to be one of the best big men. Up to that, you've got your Andre the Giants, you've got your Undertaker and stuff. But in terms of today's debate, Vader, number one.
No, I'm not necessarily the best position given that here's the list I made out for what it's worth, and there are guys who we might think, you know, aren't as good as others. I mean, and again, the other thing as well is that it really depends how you define the argument, because in terms of significance, I don't think Vader maybe is top three. Oh, I'll read the list and we'll go through the guys I've got on this list: Kamala, Yokozuna, Vader, Bam Bam Bigelow, Giant Haystacks, which is a properly interesting one, King Kong Bundy, Abdullah the Butcher, Dusty Rhodes, and Mick Foley. Now, it's interesting in the sense that when we're debating fat wrestler, you can look at a number of different categories in terms of how good they were as a wrestler. You know, like Giant Haystacks wasn't a good wrestler, but he was a massive draw.
Yes.
You know, in the same way that you look at some of the other guys. And then I look at from another angle in terms of like how over they are. Like Dusty Rhodes is, in terms of, you know, kind of like talking ability as well. Dusty Rhodes, it was a massive draw and a great talker.
Yep.
Mick Foley, as Cactus Jack, whoever he was one of the most versatile performers of the 90s.
He took whatever limitations he had, hit them by doing sick bumps.
Yeah, pretty much. But, I mean, he's one of the most significant. And other guys as well. Kamala is in his own right, you know, part of this discussion. Yokozuna was very athletic for his size. I mean,
of course.
And again, yeah, it kind of comes back to what I was saying earlier. I was like talking about wrestler here. I don't want to undercut guys who maybe we're not going to put in. But as much as Vader fits in one category, I can make the argument four or five other guys. And I'm not seeing a lot of Giant Haystacks, but boy, that guy was a draw, particularly in the UK as well.
Yeah, no, of course. But in his later days, he was certainly teamed with younger guys involved in tag matches coming for the finish. But you look at some of the guys he was teaming with, even like on your World of Sport stuff, he'd still be teaming with people like Bret Hart, Dynamite Kid, the British Bulldog. All those people were were involved in there. He'd be stuck with a guy that would do the work, the running in the early stages. Haystacks would get the tag in, crowd would go wild, he'd do the finish, everyone would have went home from that show happy because they saw Haystacks do the finish.
Yeah, yeah. And yeah, that's kind of like what Hulk Hogan became at times. It's like just get beaten up or, you know, in Haystacks' case, just not be involved, do your spots, and everyone just goes nuts for it. I mean,
it's indeed what potentially could happen at WrestleMania 13.
That is very true. That is very true. Although I do worry about Hogan even going for the leg drop.
I think it'll just be a big boot. There's a guy I feel that you've missed from your list, and I would nominate the Big Boss Man.
Yeah?
Because I thought, and I have to say, it has to be the WWF run, I think he was very agile. He was very over. I mean, even as a heel and as a face, he was still positioned very near the top of the card. He got a good reaction from the crowd. He was agile. He wasn't as agile as your Vader or your Bam Bam, but he was a big guy, and he had that the classic big guy thing. He had that believability about him.
Can I rule him out on the basis that he's not fat enough? And he's big, but I mean, yeah, I guess he's fat enough.
I think he's, and I'm, as I check Wikipedia here, I think he might have been heavier than Mick Foley, surely.
Yeah, but Mick Foley was a lot shorter.
So what are we doing, body mass index here?
Yeah, pretty much. This was not where I expected the conversation to go. It's also worth clarifying for anyone who didn't put two and two together on Mike Four is that Big Boss Man was at Starrcade as the boss. When we're in character, I didn't want to make that reference, but for anyone who didn't...
Jesse Ventura thankfully did.
Yes, that's true. He certainly did. But yeah, I mean, again, you know, it's not necessarily an argument with the right or wrong answer, and they've all got merits. Like, one thing I think is an interesting discussion, and maybe it is kind of a sign of how the WWE in 2014 now got this kind of stranglehold on the industry, is that there aren't fat men around in wrestling anymore, really. Like, when we look at all of these names, like, there was, you know, four guys in that list, Yokozuna, Vader, Bam Bam, Mick Foley, and Abdullah the Butcher was still around. There's four or five guys in that list who were all around, who were all significant players in 1993. But yeah, we look to 2014, and in part it's because, you know, Vince McMahon has a body fetish, yes. And it's in part because there's no territorial system, because the industry as a whole has just changed completely. There's not that same kind of organic rise of a guy who maybe gets over in spite of his size or thanks to his size. It's more kind of, we're going to push the guys who we think are relevant. So it's more of a closed shop. But I mean, you look at over the last 10 years in the WWE, like, Umaga sticks out.
Mark Henry? Just because of how many times the WWF have tried to make him stick out rather than how many times he's actually stuck out.
That's true. Yeah, I mean, again, my first thought was, can you call the world's strongest man in the fat wrestler category? I guess you could, but I mean, in terms of...
Not to his face, though.
Well, certainly not, although I don't think I'd call any of these guys fat to their face. They could probably outrun Giant Haystacks. But no, I think, you know, it is an interesting kind of development, and I think it is probably less of a case of there isn't that potential. It's more of a case of there isn't that site for that potential to flourish. As I say, because there aren't so many territories, and because the guys at the top, we're mainly talking about WWE, but even a company like TNA, they are in more a position where they're going to cherry pick their guys. And I think WWE don't want fat men because of the perception, and TNA don't want a fat man because of how it might make them look compared to the WWE, although I think if I was TNA and I could strike gold with a guy with an overhang, I'd do it.
But there isn't anyone, no, the only sort of, the biggest guy out there that hasn't got what you would deny and consider the wrestling physique, and in no way do I consider him to be a fat guy, would be like your Kevin Steens and stuff like that. That's probably the closest you're going to get to a guy that doesn't fit the traditional wrestling mould, but you're
he's,
right.
He's not fat in the way any of these guys are. I mean, I can't believe we're having this discussion, but you know, in the sense that he's not, you probably would classify him as a fat wrestler. I'm sure there's some Chris Hero jokes here as well that we're missing. But yeah, no, I think it is a very interesting discussion, and I think Vader, you know, again, it depends how way you look at it. I mean, in terms of, who was, I guess, possibly the one question I asked on the end, who was the most significant to the wrestling industry? I think it's probably a toss-up between Dusty Rhodes and Mick Foley.
Yes.
And I think you probably give it to Foley just about, given that he was around during the big boom period and he was a big part of that.
He's the easiest one to measure.
Yeah. That isn't a literal fat measurement joke, is it? God, we've been on too long.
I'm talking about ratings and stuff.
Right. Yes. No more bad jokes. Anyway, that's going to wrap. Well, I think we're going to mention some stuff about the network and how it plays into the show. But for all intents and purposes, that's going to wrap up this week's show. So, Craig, thank you very much for joining me.
You're very welcome. It's been a pleasure as always.
You just do all your plugs and stuff. And also, I know we spoke about this before we start recording, but also mention to people about Vader visiting Scotland last month.
Yeah, I'll do the plugs first. In terms of if you want to learn more about me for some obscure reason, if that's what you want to do, or if you just want to interact with me about wrestling, you can find me on Twitter at twitter.com/CraigW4584 and I muse about the wrestling world there. And I also write, as well as for the Scottish Sun, about what goes on up north in Jockland about in wrestling. Also write a blog about which muses about the halcyon days of wrestling. You can find that at ringthedamnbell.wordpress.com. And in terms of Vader, this was one of my all time favourite moments as a wrestling fan, right up there with the time I queued for 2.5 hours to meet Bret Hart at a book signing. And when I got to the front, I gave him the book and he said, "I hope you enjoy it." And I said, in a very high-pitched voice, "I will, thank you very much." That wasn't a great moment, but
remember, Craig, we're still on air at this point.
Yep, no, exactly. Oh, it's a very self-deprecating story.
That's
that one.
True.
But in the last couple of months, I think it was December sometime, we had Vader was appearing for British Championship Wrestling, a company that the organised family-friendly shows up in Scotland, and they were in the wrestling hotspot that is East Kilbride, in one of their community centres, and Vader was in action, as well as former TNA star Doug Williams. But I had the immense pleasure of meeting Vader, which if anyone that's listened to the whole show so far may have picked up on the fact that I'm quite partial to Vader, and it was just totally cool. The guy was awesome, posed for a photograph, and just before the photographer was clicking, when he was doing his countdown, "Get ready, I'm going to take it," we both did, "It's Vader time," and it was just totally cool. Cheesy goodness, but he was such a nice guy. And my earliest memories of Vader was when he had the smoking skull, smoking helmet thing in WCW, and I was terrified by him. And it was just great to meet a hero. And I didn't speak in a high-pitched voice.
Well done for that. And I was going to say, I think in terms of Vader's career, this probably is it's the peak in terms of there are different ways you can measure peak, but in terms of the height and in terms of how well-renowned he is, I think 93 is probably his best year.
I think so. I think, for me, I think WWE missed something with him. I think, he's talked about backstage problems, the whole Shawn Michaels thing at SummerSlam 96, etc. I just don't think they did enough with him. He came in with a bang, hitting Gorilla Monsoon with the Vader bomb and everything like that, but he just didn't really amount to as much as he thought he might have done. So yeah, I think 93, I think Vader will look back in terms of the Western wrestling. I mean, he was a huge star in Japan. So I think he's probably going to look at selling out 50,000 and 60,000 seater stadiums with a lot of relish and everything like that. But in terms of the appearances in America, I think it's got to be 93.
No, that's certainly true. One thing we didn't do, although I think we're both going to say Vader against Flair is our moment of the month. I'm assuming you're with me on that as well.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So just for anyone who's counting, for anyone who maybe when this show gets mega famous in 5 years' time is compiling our Wikipedia page, our moment of the month section is unanimously Vader against Ric Flair. Before I do my plugs and wrap up, I think the other thing to mention as well, now that we're in retrospective chat, is the launch of the WWE Network, or the announcement of it. Yeah. It's not going to be available here, at least, in the UK for a probably better part of a year, which is a bit of a shame. And I know people who follow me on Twitter at Bobby Bamble know I have my own reservations about it, although that's mainly about whether WWE can hit the numbers that we believe they're trying to hit. But that's not for now. What it means for the Wrestling 20 Years Ago project is that, you know, this vault of library, I think, is certainly going to massively play into this project in terms of having all the pay-per-views available at the click of a button. It's not going to stop what we do, particularly while I don't have access to it. It's very difficult for me to say, right, let's go and watch WrestleMania 10 and I haven't got the network. But I'm hoping it's going to enable more of you guys to be able to more easily at least kind of join in rather than having to base off the links off YouTube or stuff we provide and things like that. But again, so the stuff about the network, but in terms of this project, again, going forward, we've got 94, we're a bit late this month, but we'll be back into our kind of end of the month cycle. We've got the Rumble coming up, in a couple of weeks. I might move that that could be next weekend, actually, me live tweeting it, so it's not in the same weekend as the actual Royal Rumble, because I kind of want to keep those apart. But keep an eye on Twitter for that, at Wrestling20YRS. We're our website, Wrestling20Years.com. Just to all the other episodes we've done so far. And that's about it, as my voice is starting to go hoarse. So I think I'm going to sign off now. So I've been Bob Bamber. He's been
Craig. Was that a Lillian Garcia joke?
No. No, not quite. Not by design, anyway. But anyway, until next time. This has been the Wrestling 20 Years Ago podcast for December of 1993. Goodbye.